Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of It's Easy Sun, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. And with me, I have a good friend, colleague, so many ways I can describe my guest today, because she has been someone that I've worked with, learned from, watched, and quite frankly, now we work together to try to help our nation's HBCUs with their leadership. And she's doing a lot. She's very humble. A lot of the HBCUs won't know this, but because of her, some of the things that has happened recently with the during the pandemic and some of the benefits that some have garnered really was because of her effort. She won't talk about it, so I'll say it up front. And she has just been a wonderful friend and colleague and someone who I say is sold out to see young people succeed. Ladies and gentlemen, joining me on the podcast today is my good friend, Dr. Phyllis Worthy Dawkins. Dr. Dawkins or Phyllis, how are you?
Hello, how are you? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, good afternoon. So, like I do with all the guests, we don't have any preset questions. So what we'll do is we'll jump in. I'll just start out with an open-ended question. And then based on your responses, we'll have a conversation. And believe it, before you know it, an hour is gone. So with that, you want to jump right in? Are you ready?
I'm ready.
You're ready. Okay. Well, tell us, who is Dr. Phyllis Worthy Dawkins, your early years, your family, your grounding, all the things that were poured into you to make you who you are today.
Okay. I'm Phyllis Worthy Dawkins, born and raised in Asheville, North Carolina, in the projects. So I grew up in the projects, and I went to Asheville High School, and I went on to Johnson C. Smith University as an undergrad, and to the University of Michigan for my first graduate degree, Master's of Arts in Physical Education, Adaptive Physical Education, working with special populations. And then I went on to Ohio State, but before I went to Ohio State, I had a stint at South Carolina State University, where I taught there for 2 years, and then went on to Johnson C. Smith. And so that's pretty much an overview. I have three brothers and two brothers and one stepsister. And we grew up together in Asheville. And my stepsister grew up in New York. And so we've had a tough journey, but a productive journey. And here I am today.
Yeah. So three brothers and a stepsister.
Two brothers and a stepsister. Right.
So what was home like? I did not know you were from Asheville, North Carolina.
Yes,
so
I am.
Isn't that where that beautiful Biltmore is?
Biltmore House, very liberal city. Okay, yeah. Very liberal city. I always say it's the city where all the leftover hippies, they reside, and they are somewhere in those Smoky Mountains, Blue Ridge Mountains, uh-huh. And they come down on the weekend in the tourist city of Asheville. Biltmore.
House. I've been to Asheville a couple of times, but I've never, and I heard you say the projects in Asheville. I've never would have envisioned projects in Asheville. So what was home life like? Mom, dad, and with your
siblings? It was, grew up extremely poor. As I told some colleagues recently, I learned how to hustle. I learned how to survive. My parents separated when I was in second or fourth grade. And I always say that I need to nail it down, but both are dead now. Mm-hmm. And, growing up without lunch money, I also learned to play hooky from school. but I got back on the right track when they offered free and reduced lunch. So I tell that story just recently. And also that story helped me to get a recent Zuckerberg grant about how my life turned around when they started offering free and reduced lunch.
Wow. So you were playing hooky from school because you didn't have the lunch money?
Or? I didn't have lunch money.
Wow.
And the kids that didn't have lunch money, we used to sit at one end of the table, the lunch table, and watch the people that had lunch money eat. Wow. And so lunch was only a quarter during those days. But when they start offering free and reduced lunch, it changed my life. The first year of that program was in the eighth grade. And that was the first year, my first award. I received perfect attendance that first year. So that turned my life around. And that degree is hanging on my wall upstairs in my office. Okay.
Wow.
That certificate. Certificate.
Certificate.
Yes.
So we're going to get to this later, but you're a scholar and educator. You are someone that has mentored so many young people, young professionals.
Mm-hmm.
Is it safe to say this little story you shared here,
mm-hmm.
was that an inspiration for you going into the field of higher education, or was it something that was innate to say, look, I don't want others to endure what I had to endure?
It was an incentive to pay attention to my career. It was an incentive to take education seriously. And later on, when I had kids, I used to give my children extra lunch money to give to other kids that couldn't afford lunch.
Wow.
Okay,
wow.
So we did that for several years until one of my children said, Mom, they ripping you off. So we stopped that because I forgot they had free and reduced lunch.
Yeah.
But it was an incentive to pay attention to my education, to keep me from doing things that I was doing as a hustler in the projects. So it really brought integrity into my life, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it helped me to refocus my education.
Mm. So early years growing up, what was the school environment like? Aside from the lunch, what were some of the interests for you in your pursuit of your education from as early as you can remember? Because now you're a scholar, world-renowned, former president, executive, all these things. So what was the educational journey like?
Well, I grew up in the segregation South, okay? Mm-hmm. I grew up when from first grade to eighth grade, we were in a separate but equal situation. So in going into my ninth grade, I was part of an integrated high school, and that also changed my life. I was the first cheerleader of an integrated high school called Asheville High School. We moved from South Orangeburg High School to Asheville High School, and part of the first class to integrate the high school. That was a large, predominantly white high school. And I was placed on the educational track, the college track, and very few black students in that track. Most of them were placed into the vocational track. And so that was an interesting lifestyle or educational style, being the only black in many of my classes. And no one saying hello to you or speaking to you during that time. But I listened. And I listened to them talk about going to college. And I said to myself, I'm going to college as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so that inspired me to apply to several institutions before I landed at Johnson C. Smith.
Mm-hmm. So who was the driving force behind that educational push? Was it mom, dad, or was it just you innately gathering that because you're saying, look, I have to find another way? Is it a mixture, or is it more clearly defined yourself or your environment with your family?
Not only was it listening to other high school students talking about going to college, my mother supported me in this track. My aunt Ruth, who was a Zeta, and she put me into the debutante ball. Just recently, I spoke at a debutante ball 2 months ago in Greensboro, North Carolina. And my Aunt Ruth put me into what they call society by bringing me out in the debutante ball and then just helping me think beyond my immediate settings. Helped me think beyond where I lived, but helped me envision where I could go. Okay. Yeah. And so with that support from mom, my aunt, and families and friends, that set me on a journey towards college.
Yeah.
And then with college, you know, you had to afford it. And so lots of people contributed to my financial support while I was in college. My dad, my mom and dad separated, but my dad also supported, and his sisters in South Carolina supported my journey as well.
Wow. So you get to Johnson C. Smith in the Queen City. You know, you that's where you and I met. A great institution, a legacy and a history that is so rich. All the things that Johnson C. Smith has done in the movement and all the other things, the lunch counter. Dr. Yancey has been a guest on, and we also just understanding the history of Johnson C. Smith. What did Johnson C. Smith mean to you as a young person coming from Asheville, North Carolina?
Well, let's just say when I started that journey, coming off high school, where I also played sports, and that was before Title IX sports, so we used to play interscholastic sports, local high schools playing each other. I didn't know much about the educational environment, so I remember at the registration desk them asking, what do you want to major in? And I said, basketball. And they said, we don't have basketball. I said, okay, what do you have close to that? They said, physical education. So that's what started me in physical education.
Really? That was the journey in physical education? Wow.
And that was my journey into physical education. And quickly, when I arrived at Johnson C. Smith, I had arrived from being at Ohio State, completing 2 years of my course requirements for my doctoral degree, had one more year to finish. And then so for the first year I was just an instructor. Quickly, my first assignment in leadership was coordinating the equipment room. So I always tell people, it's not the job you get, it's what you do with it. And so I did an amazing job of organizing it, creating the inventory, work study students, setting up a sign and table. And that one little task led me to department chair. They figured if I could organize, you have to imagine tennis balls, baseballs all over the floor and everywhere. So I was able to set up a system. Okay, so that was my first leadership job at Johnson C. Smith, coordinate the equipment room, which led to me being becoming the department chair and later a dean and eventually vice president upon when Dr. Yancey left.
But weren't you a cheerleader?
Yes, as an undergrad.
As an undergrad, you were a cheerleader. So tell us a little bit about that. So sports, you did cheerleading in high school, you said, the first integrated high school, you did cheerleading. That just followed you all the way to Smith and beyond?
Yeah, so, okay, right. Let me get back to undergrad. That's where you take me back, okay? In undergrad, I was a cheerleader, and I was a cheerleader for 4 years. I was a cheerleader in high school from junior high throughout high school. So I had all this cheerleading experience. And when you become a cheerleader, you learn leadership. Being in sports, as you know, Gerald, because you play sports, you learn leadership skills also. Mm-hmm. And so I learned to manage. I learned to, by being around other people, because you had to keep up your grades as well in order to play, you made sure your grades were up to par. So throughout my year, I was a cheerleader, I became cheerleading captain, and then eventually when I graduated from Johnson C. Smith, and also I was first runner-up for Miss Johnson C. Smith. So that
was, I did not know that.
Okay. I forgot to tell anybody about that. And then also, while at Johnson C. Smith, I joined a sorority, Delta Sigma Theta sorority. So I had a social life as well as an educational career path that the coaches in the department, and mostly coaches teaching physical education, needed me to help them lead the department. But they provided me a great educational experience as an undergrad, and then later on coming back to work there.
Yeah. Now, you're known as a leader and someone who likes to drive change and and improve every situation you're in. And you said something earlier that stuck with me. It said, it's not the job, but what you do with it. So it seems to me, just listening to you talk about undergrad, all of that was already innately within you. Is that a fair statement?
That is a very fair statement. Even in undergrad, I had various leadership assignments, okay? In Delta, I was the treasurer of the Delta Sigma Theta undergraduate group. I was the leader of the cheerleaders for a period of time near my senior year. And then I was, you know, over different clubs. So those leadership skills started coming out more and more. Sometimes you don't even know you're a leader, and other people see that in you. So they begin to nominate you for positions, okay? Yeah. So even when I ran for Miss Johnson C. Smith, I didn't see myself in that position. I was too busy being a cheerleader, but that also presented a leadership opportunity. So leadership started early for me as an undergrad and continued on into my master's degree program.
So the master's, you went to Michigan for master's, that's what, right?
Yes, I went to the University of Michigan.
Yeah, I got to remember, it's the University of Michigan. So the major and the discipline, it just stayed with it, stayed with the physical sciences. So is it safe to say you just fell in love with that aspect and you wanted to become this scholar in this field?
I did. And during my summer during my summers at Johnson C. Smith, what attracted me to Michigan was that I used to work at a camp in the Upper Peninsula in Traverse City of Michigan, and I fell in love with the Great Lakes. And so that's what attracted me to Michigan. And so when I went there, I also was attracted to special education. So the degree was in physical education, pro recreation, or special populations. And so that emphasis in special education also followed me later when I went to The Ohio State University.
I noticed you said The Ohio State University.
Yes, both of them.
You got that one right. So, and the transition to the doctoral was just the same. Same liking, same tenacity, same, I guess, career path. Now, did you see yourself as a college and you at that time, did you see yourself as a later on college or university administrator, or did you just see yourself as wanting to become a scholar in this field?
Good question. What I saw was when I received my master's degree, I went to South Carolina State. And while there was another gentleman with a similar degree. And he was moving. Now, at that time, I had a master's and he had a doctorate. And I noticed that if I'm going to move up in higher education, I need to go ahead and pursue my doctoral degree. So that set the vision for that doctoral degree. So I was only at South Carolina State 2 years. And while at South Carolina State, I learned a lot about teaching activity classes. I was just 22 years of age when I started my journey at South Carolina State. And then I went to left there and went to The Ohio State University and stayed there for 3 years with a focus on continuing my journey in higher education, but with a degree that I needed to move ahead. Mm-hmm. So while at The Ohio State, and just before I left, I met my current husband, Bobby Dawkins, who's also a graduate of Johnson C. Smith, and he had just completed his doctorate degree from Cornell University in chemistry. Okay.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And so I was transitioning to work on my doctorate. He had just completed his degree, and he was transitioning to Charlotte to work for a company called Celanese. And so I was there for 3 years while we dated, but I learned a lot in preparation for my degree. And then that's when I came to Johnson C. Smith. I came to Johnson C. Smith after completing 3 years of coursework, and but had a family. Family got in the way, so it took me an additional 2 years to finish my doctorate degree. Okay.
But it's very interesting because you said when you left South Carolina State, or you were at South Carolina State, you were only 22 years old.
When I left South Carolina State, I was probably 24, but when I arrived, I was 22.
Wow.
And I arrived there coming off the 70s, 80s experience, 70s experience, 22, had the students call me by my first name, coming from Michigan where everything was so liberal at the time, nobody ironed their clothes, and then I had to quickly transition, go, oh, this is not going to work. Some of the students were older than I was, and I had to quickly change that calling, allow them to call me Phyllis. Mm-hmm. And then I had to quickly change that to Miss Dawkins, and I began to iron my clothes and look professional. Right? And when one of the faculty members said, Miss Dawkins, Phyllis, that's not working. I'm going, you're right. And I was too young, and some of the students were trying to date me. I was going, no, this is not going to work.
No.
But South Carolina State helped me to focus my career, okay, and to what I needed to be. So it was a good journey. It was in a small town, but it set my vision for what I needed to do next.
Well, you know, I'm going to ask you a question right here before we get into the professional career and, and what where I came to know you. You just shared a journey and a story. When you look at young people, you've been a college president now two or three times over. And one of them was at Bennett College, where we had where it's a female institution. When you sit down today and you think about the journey that you just shared, and you see young people from a presidential perspective, because you know you were responsible for shaping and changing lives. Do you see that same level of tenacity, or what has changed? Is it changed for differences in society today? You know, the hustling is not there as much. I don't know what it is. But when you sit today and look at your journey and juxtapose it for the young people that will come through your hands, what are some of the differences and similarities you see?
That's a good question. I just finished our June residency, so I'm going to jump way ahead, okay?
Okay, all right.
So, like, currently, I'm the executive director of the HBCU Executive Leadership Institute. And this past Friday, I just returned from Clark Atlanta. The program is housed at Clark Atlanta, and we had a three-day residency program, and you are a participant in my program. And so here's what we have: 22 fellows, and the current fellows are people with at the dean's level or higher, vice presidents and provosts. And I see in them these current leaders more of a strategic focus for higher education, and I'm not even going to say post-pandemic, but I'm going to say a vision for the future that we didn't have, okay?
Wow.
That's more innovative and progressive and requires a different kind of leadership, but still with some of the challenges. But an understanding that it's a sequence that they need to follow in order to succeed. So while we also had that vision when we came through higher education, there's the current vision requires them to move faster and learn quicker, and you make use of mentors and coaches as they proceed. We had informal coaches and mentors. We declared each other as our coach or mentor. Whenever I had a financial problem, I called you, Gerald. I called Dr. Yancey. I mean, we didn't always formally have them as coaches and mentors, but we had people that we could call on. Now their coaches and mentors are more formal coaches and mentors. The challenges are still there, but I think the challenges are even greater for the current administrators.
I would agree with you 100%. I call it the new normal, and to hear you say they're having to learn faster. But when you were coming up and as a dean, say at Johnson C. Smith, and we all had the pleasure of working with Dorothy Yancey and her mentorship, and I stole a lot from her just watching her, how she handled situations, how she moved teams along. But when you were coming through, what were some of the things that you kind of held to that kind of brought you through that whole process? Because you were basically being set up for leadership at a higher level later on in your career. What was the time at Johnson C. Smith like, being a dean and coming back to your alma mater?
Yes, when I arrived at Johnson C. Smith as an administrator, I served under Greenfield. He was the president at that time, and then I served for a number of years under Robert Albright, and my longest years of service were under Dr. Yancey, throughout her time there. And then I left when Ron Carter was in office. I was there a total of 28 years. And what we learned during our journey there was the importance of building a good team. And at Johnson C. Smith, I always said that it wasn't just one person that made up that institution during the Yancey years, during the Albright years, during the Greenfield years. It was, we built lots of team members that could carry on whether we were there or not, okay? I ran, not only did I go through the ranks of directing the equipment room to a department chair to dean, and then to vice president, and back to dean by the time I left, I also went through all the ranks on the faculty side, from an instructor to an assistant professor to an associate professor to a professor. So I went through publications, publishing, and doing all those types of things. But also on the administrative side, I learned governance. And I really think that has helped me a lot. I said to one of my fellows yesterday, that it's important you understand policies and procedures and that keeps you safe. when you can quote policies and guidelines. So I also went through serving on committees, on the Education Policies Committee, president of the Faculty Senate, okay? That was eye-opening. So that governance structure, as well as that administrative structure, as well as that faculty structure, just having that experience during my 28 years helped me when I transitioned to Dillon University in New Orleans. And then I realized I knew a whole lot after being at Johnson C. Smith. Sometimes you don't know what you know until you get to the next environment. Yes. I'm sure you experienced that, Gerald, when you came to Johnson C. Smith, and then you left Smith and went to Ithaca, okay? Yes. Mm-hmm. And so we learn, and working at an HBCU, you learn so much, okay?
Because you got to do everything pretty much.
You got to do everything. You learn everybody's job, right? Yes. And then the others. And so the breadth of experience that I learned at Johnson C. Smith helped me to be successful when I arrived at Dillard, and we had accreditation challenges. So I learned. When I transitioned to Dillard University and then on to Cheney and then Bennett, at one point during my career, I was known as the cleanup woman, okay? Oh, yes. Because I help institutions with their accreditation, faculty development challenges. And in the end, I have been to 81 of the 101 HBCUs.
Okay? Really? Wow.
Yes. Just hit 81 about 3 months ago. I was at Kentucky State doing a presentation to the students.
Yeah. Okay. But, you know, it's funny because sometimes my wife will say to me that I'm a glutton for punishment because almost everywhere that I go, it's something I'm doing in line with trying to help a president do something. Right.
Right.
But you went to Cheney at a most interesting time. Our good friend Jeffrey Smith, may his soul rest in peace.
Yeah.
I would say he was one of the best student affairs vice presidents anybody could ever have. But you had to, talking about building a team, you had to deal with that. And you left Cheney and you had to go to Bennett and do the same thing. So can you talk to us a little bit about the preparation that you had, but then also now, you were president, so you have to execute on those things. What was the difference in your mind?
Well, when I arrived at Cheney, I was the provost, okay, and the senior vice president for academic affairs. And then the president left, and I became the acting president. And during my time as acting president, I hired Jeffrey Smith, and I have to say, it was a short stint because he died while he was at Cheney in the apartment complex that the two of us lived in. Mm-hmm. And so that was unfortunate, but I had the opportunity of working with Jeffrey Smith, who was the vice president for student affairs at Johnson C. Smith for a number of years. So Jeff, hiring Jeff at Cheney was part of me building my team. And I can't say that enough for people in leadership. You can't do it by yourself. You need a strong working team. And unfortunately, Jeff died within 2 weeks. He was there less than a month at Cheney. But my acting presidency opened the door for me really thinking about it's time to become a president. And I learned a lot once again about accreditation. So my strength continued to be at Cheney was getting through Cheney through accreditation. And we successfully did that. We successfully did that at Dillard. And notice the word I use, we. It's not just me, it's we. We successfully did it at Johnson C. Smith. We to the point at that time they had just updated the standards, and we were one of the first institutions to go through those new standards, and that's what also enhanced me to visit a lot of schools because they wanted to know how did we do it.
Okay, yeah, we got zero recommendations.
Exactly, zero recommendations. Went on to Dillard University, had a big challenge there. They had 46 accreditation recommendations. 46 out of 77 at that time, and helped them get through that with zero recommendations.
Wow.
At the end.
Wow. Wow.
And then went to Cheney, who had challenges, got them through accreditation with zero recommendations, all right?
Wow.
So that was my skill set. And that really, even though I never really used my degree, physical education degree, that emphasis I had in special education, psychology of mental retardation, taught me a lot about assessment. Mm. So sometimes you may not use the degree that you received, in the way that it was awarded to you. I never, other than working in the physical education department, I never used that special ed degree other than it taught me a lot about assessment and evaluation. Okay. Doing those IEPs, learning how to write those are the same skill sets you need to write objectives and goals for grants, for assessments. So that helped me with accreditation and helping institutions get through that. So then when I arrived at Bennett College, those same skills hit me again, and I don't need to go into another school that has a challenge again, a financial accreditation challenge. But each one of those schools, I left those schools with those skills and helped them get through whatever challenges they had.
Yeah, okay? And I would tell you, I used to admire you from a distance in terms of what you had to navigate, because every now and then you'd give me a call and we'll talk about the issues, and I'm like, wow.
But you showed up everywhere I needed you to show up.
You know, that's what friends are for. And as I told you many times before, I might no longer work at an HBCU, but I'm just behind the scenes answering questions for presidents and trustees all the time. So that is something that that is my ministry. Believe I told you that. That is my ministry. So you were literally living out the statement you just made, that it is not the job, but what you do with it, because you weren't using your degree the way you thought. You weren't necessarily doing exactly what you wanted to do, but you were, in fact, making a difference. When you look back now, how does that strike you with all the work that you're doing and now what you're doing with the HBCU Educational Leadership Institute? How did you see this, or maybe you didn't see it, but as you reflect, how you see it coming all together?
Well, that's a good question. So when I think of my time at Johnson C. Smith and think about all that we did a lot. And during that time working with Dr. Yancey, we received the MacArthur Genius Award. And it was awarded with emphasis in faculty development, our honors program, and service learning. Those were the three areas. And we did those three things well for years. And used to go around the country speaking about those. We're also known for learning communities, for our honors program. We had so many programs. So when I left Smith, I took those skills with me. My legacy at Dillard was the reaffirmation of the institution, but also I came to Dillard right after Hurricane Katrina, and I learned a lot about finances and endowments, okay? And our biggest gift there before I left was a $25 million gift from NIH that I co-wrote with Marvelline Hughes, who was the president. So when I look at my legacy at Dillard, I think about accreditation. I think about rebuilding the campus after Hurricane Katrina. I think about that NIH grant that we got for $25 million for the nursing program. It was endowment. It provided $25 million to the endowment then. And then I hit Cheney, and we have other challenges, financial challenges. So I think about, what did I leave there? Because at each institution of higher education, you left a footprint of something you did and something you grow from. So at Cheney, it was the reaffirmation of the institution for 10 years and the restructuring of academic affairs. I learned a lot about working with unions. You probably ran into unions where you were. And it was a public institution versus a private institution. So I learned about how do you navigate unions and continuation for accreditation. And then I hit Bennett with all the financial challenges. And I learned a lot more about academic program restructuring, reorganization. And accreditation, always accreditation, hits me wherever I go. I need to study that more before I take on an institution. But we also had some financial challenges, and that led me to the Stand with Bennett campaign that we did, where we had to raise $5 million in 60 days.
Yeah, okay? I remember that. You know, and I said at the start of the show that you're a very humble individual and you don't want to talk about it. But the pandemic hit while I was at Morehouse. And I remember you working behind the scenes, calling, asking questions, trying to figure out how we can get things into bills and making connections on Capitol Hill and all these things. Mm-hmm. You don't talk about that much. And the results from that were so many HBCUs benefited from those efforts. Why do you always, is it that you just want to remain in the background on those things? Or are you just a servant leader? But those of us that were there, we are eternally grateful to you for those efforts. So why is there something you just want to say, Gerald, I want to be in the background. All I want to do is just lead in a servant way and let everybody else get the shine and the glory and all that stuff.
Well, when you, this goes back to my notion of your contributions to each institution. So my contributions to Bennett College and arriving there and finding out that we were on warning and then probation and discovering that at that time we were experiencing a $1.3 million deficit per year. And I recall going to the Ray Charles Foundation and asking them for support and getting into the world of fundraising. And I recall Ray Charles said, even if we gave you $1.3 million, what's going to happen the next year and the next year? And so that led me to think about our HBCU capital loan. And that's what was holding us up. We were experiencing a $1.3 million deficit per year, but yeah, we were paying that loan, which was about a 1.3, a 1.1. So teamed up with UNCF and my team, Evelyn Leathers and myself, Leroy Simmons, went to UNCF and asked UNCF to go with us to Department of Ed to see if we can get that loan forgiven. Initially, it was a request to forgive the loan, similar to what they had just recently done with the Katrina schools, okay? Mm-hmm. And Dillard was one of them, where I was previously. And so they said it would take an act of Congress. So we left the Department of Education. That was January of 2018. And needless to say, in 48 days, we got a deferment for not only Bennett College, but for another 8 to 10 institutions. So that deferment opened up that door for the most recent award to forgive all HBCUs to the tune of $1.3 billion.
Yes, ma'am.
And girl, you were probably at Morehouse at that time where they forgave the loans. Just imagine. Some schools had loans up to $200 million, down to as low as $15 million, mm-hmm. for the administration to forgive those loans. And I have to say, it was the Trump administration on their way out the door forgave us for that loan, mm-hmm. to the tune of $1.3 billion. So we went from deferment to total erasure of the loans, mm-hmm. which helped us to reset. Our financial settings at our institutions.
Yeah. So when you think about all of that, mm-hmm. Dr. Dawkins, mm-hmm. and there are going to be people listening, you know, every week they listen into this, and they're always mm-hmm. fascinated by the stories and the journeys of the guests and everything. What three things would you say are necessary for leaders in our HBCU space, or in the spaces, not even HBCUs, but higher ed in general, because the difference between the two oftentimes is resources, endowment, support, and things of that nature. There's some other social things behind that too. But what three things would you share with folks that are listening around the topic of leadership, in your estimation?
Let me build upon what I've already said.
Okay.
I think it's learning to work on both sides of the aisle. okay, of the owl, owls, in the sense that when I was also during my time at Bennett College, I was on the president's board of advisory on HBCUs. So, and also going through that HBCU Capital Loan experience, I learned that you have to work on both sides of the political aisles, and that you have to keep in mind that you are trying to move your institution forward financially, get it stable so that it has a future, a future as a historically black college, and that you have to work with all kinds of people in order for your institution to survive. And with historically black colleges, my experience working now at six of them, and I've only worked at historically black colleges, that you have to, as a president and as a leader, not only do you have to work internally with your constituent groups, but you also have to work externally, not only with your board, but with others, foundations and corporations and politicians, to help stabilize your institution. So it's bigger than just the day-to-day operations as a president, but you have to envision yourself as a leader that can work with a variety of different people. When I went through the Stand with Bennett campaign, I learned a lot. I am going to write that book one day about that.
Yeah. I'll buy it.
In 60 days, I learned to work with churches, with one church that donated, made a donation to Bennett. They took up money and raised $10,000 during their service, okay? Church in Atlanta, Georgia. And then the other churches started competing. And Alpha Street Baptist Church gave me the largest donation. But so you had the churches competing. Alpha Street Baptist Church gave me a donation of $50,000, okay? And then there were the fraternities and sororities, first being led by Glenda Glover at Tennessee State, who was president of AKAs, and now I'm a Delta. She's president of AKAs. Once again, working on both sides of the aisles, and they gave $100,000 donation that led to competition between the Greeks, where Alphas and Deltas, my sorority also contributed. And so that was a competition. And then the social media, we learned a lot about social media and how you use social media to make contributions. So what I'd like to summarize that whole experience and say, you just have to learn as a leader to work and be open to a variety of different people that could, that can contribute to the growth of your institution.
So well said, so well said. I told you an hour would go by pretty quickly. I have a lot more questions to ask, but we have about 12 minutes left. So, but before we close, I definitely want to ask you a question that I've asked several of my guests. If you had your druthers today, if you had your druthers and you could, and resources was not an issue, what is the main thing that you would work on in terms of how it impacts young people and young professionals today?
I think what I would continue to do, and I try to do this now even in my executive leadership program, is to emphasize that leaders have to continuously grow and continue to participate in workshops and conferences and seminars. When you get your degree, it doesn't stop. It's a continuous growth process. And so you have to stay current. And that's one thing that I would say. You have to stay, as a leader, stay current, continue to innovate, and continue to figure out, how do I take this institution into the future? while the traditions are valuable, are they still relevant today?
Wow.
What? Wow. What? Sound like a person that's gone through this? Yes. And to what extent can I take from the past into the future? And what do I need to leave behind that's no longer relevant for today's students, for today's institution, so that my institution can continue to flourish and to grow and provide the skills and knowledge and abilities that our students need as they go out into the world.
So I'm going to flip it a little bit now and ask you to personalize it in terms of if a young person today, young lady, let's say Bennett, young lady comes into your office or she stops you in the airport. You're sitting in the waiting lounge for the, your plane and she recognizes you and she comes to sit next to you. What is the top thing that you would tell her to do? All of what you just said. Tie that to a singular young lady that's sitting right in front of you and she knows of all the things that you've done. What would you say to that young lady?
I would say to listen. To listen to your past leaders, to your current leaders, and by listening, what things will you take to impact what you're doing today? Listening is a hard skill, but it is a skill that I learned over time that by just sitting there and listening to all the people in the room speak, I can learn a lot. I can learn from my elders. I can learn from my current students. I can learn from my colleagues. And then the other thing I would say, as a new leader, allow discourse, allow debate in the meeting room. You learn a lot. One of my colleagues, you know him, Frank Parker.
Yes, sir. Frank.
At Johnson C. Smith. And some of my other colleagues, Harriet Richard and Lynette Fox, and I can just go on and on. We used to debate each other in the meetings and then go out to lunch later, okay? And somebody said to me one time, how do y'all do that? I said, we learn. I learned from a Frank Parker. The things that you agree or disagree with, there's a growth spurt in that moment that takes you to a higher level, okay? And so by listening and experiencing from your lived experiences, that allows you to move forward and continue with whatever challenges you have now and into the future.
So well said, so well said. My last question is going to kind of put you on the spot and ask you to draw deep into your spiritual side, I guess.
And, right.
This podcast, believe it or not, believe it, we're close to 70 episodes. You believe that?
Wow.
Yeah. I was interviewing someone just yesterday and it hit me. I'm like, I'm not a journalist or a communications person. I'm an accountant. And just so fate would have it, like you said, I'm gonna use that quote, your quote, it is not the job but what you do with it. But this job has been so much fun, just interviewing folks like yourself. But the inspiration that comes from this podcast and what the feedback that we get is really about helping people who might be in the pandemic, coming out of the pandemic. We see what's happening with inflation. We see what's happening with jobs and if you're not already prepared, you might have a sense of, for lack of a better word, hopelessness. So using a kind of a pastoral emphasis, words of inspiration and encouragement, what could you leave with our audience today as our final question? Plus the fact you're a new grandma and all these things. How would you tie all of that together to give us some words of inspiration?
I would say believe in yourself, believe in God, believe that there's a higher person that's supporting you. I get words of inspiration every morning from a colleague at from Dillard and from Prior Review, okay? And she sends us these little, my colleague from Dillard sends us these little words of inspiration, little prayer notes every morning. And that keeps me focused and believing that we can make a difference at our institutions. So believing that you can lead with courage, as I always say, lead with inspiration, lead with integrity, you can make a difference in the world, in young people. And things will happen to you, but just as long as you keep those beliefs, you will survive. Okay? And the higher up you go, you will be met with challenges in your life. It's how you deal with them that makes a difference. Okay? And so just be strong and keep the faith and moving forward. Okay?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Well, I will tell you, it has been an honor and pleasure to work with you over these many years. Mm-hmm. I remember when we were working together at Johnson C. Smith on the Sachs reaccreditation. And you are right, Frank Parker is very, very, he'll debate you from now till a century from now. But he always has these words of wisdom, and his colleagues like yourself and others that has helped me. I was sharing recently with a group of people that every place that I've been, I try to do exactly what you said, and that was listen and absorb. And Dr. Yancey always tells us, remain humble and teachable. And you have been one of the people that I absorb quite a bit with in terms of how to manage the academic side of the house. And I'm always grateful for that. So I just wanted to make sure before we ended, I say that. Okay. Is there anything that you'd like to share that I didn't ask by way of a question? This is going to be one of my better interviews. I know it. a lot of young ladies are going to find a lot of strength and power in this conversation. But is there anything that I didn't ask a question of, or something on your heart that you'd like to share with the audience?
I would just say, in my current role at Clark Atlanta University, for the HBCU Executive Leadership Institute, I am so inspired by the 12 advisory board members that I have: Sullivan, Parm, Johnny Parm, Louis Sullivan, founder of Morehouse School of Medicine, Johnny Parm, first executive director of the Thurgood Marshall Foundation. Dr. Yancey is involved in the program, so I continue to work with Dr. Yancey. My dean in the School of Education at CAU, and my team, Cheryl Davenport-Dozier, Dr. Hooper, and Dr. Turner. Once again, the success of this leadership program is built on the experience of other leaders and current leaders. And so that program has, it touches 40 to 50 current and past presidents and higher education administrators such as you, including Dr. Newman that we work with at Johnson C. Smith University. Those leaders are given back to current leaders, okay, based on their lived experiences as leaders. And so we continue to impact future leaders for the future of HBCUs. And so that's what my life has been about, and that's what I'm continuing to do. And thank you. Thank you, Bill, for helping
me. And that program is great, and I enjoy spending time with the cohorts. I hope I'm sharing something that they can take away.
Hey, just this week, one of the fellows mentioned how great your presentation was, and you have ranked so far the highest of all my leaders. I'm not just saying that because I'm on your show, but because of what you bestowed upon them during your virtual presentation to them, and they ranked you very high. I think you even got 5 out of 5. I'll send you your results.
Oh my goodness. I tell people all the time, the good Lord looks out for fools and babies, and I'm not a baby. So I will always be grateful. Any way that I can help, I try to do so, because I do believe those of us that came through an HBCU experience, Johnson C. Smith, Howard, whichever one of the 104 HBCUs, something was placed on our shoulders that is for us to give back. Yes. And any way that I can give back to help to lift HBCUs and other minority serving communities, I'll always do it. It is my humble pleasure to do so. Well, Dr. Dawkins, believe it or not, we're at an hour. And I want to say thank you so much. We were worried about you being outside. The noise wasn't that bad. No airplane came over. I think you had one or two woodpeckers, but that's okay.
Yes.
It turned out just fine. And I thank you for joining me and being a part of what we're trying to do here in inspiring others to see their station in life a little bit differently based on your lived experiences and the experiences of other guests. So thank you so much. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've just spent the last hour with Dr. Phyllis Worthy Dawkins, a colleague, a friend, a leader, a servant leader, and someone who is sold out to ensure that we extend the legacies of the nation's HBCUs, not only just the institutions themselves, but the graduates. I always go back to the expression, getting those diamonds in the rough, polishing them up, and launching them into the future. So I hope something she's shared here today inspires, piques your interest, and causes you to pause, make an assessment, and then go forward and be great. So until next week, remember, this is It's Easy, Son, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. Take care and have a great week.
Thank you.